Christ Out the Podcast. I am your co-host, Andrew Morgan, alongside Cornelius Swart. How you doing today, man?
I'm doing good, man. How are you?
I'm doing really great. It's Juneteenth as we're recording this, so, you know, it's a little bit of a, I don't know if you want to call
it's
it
a big holiday.
But yeah, it should be a celebration of freedom. You know,
what is Juneteenth for folks who don't know?
June 19th is the day that individuals celebrate the freedom of African Americans from slavery. And I feel like, and one of the things I've always said is this is more or less the true celebration of America inching toward its actual independence, you know, as far as setting everyone free.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we still have a lot of ways to go, but that's what it is. It's the celebration of allowing African Americans to be considered 5/5 human. So, yeah.
And this is, and so June 19th was when word of the Emancipation Proclamation
yes.
reached Texas,
yeah.
which was like 2 years after
Yeah, yeah.
They were so like, oh, we forgot to tell you that you're free.
And by the way, and that's why I always say it's the celebration of, because it's like
right.
when you go back and you look at it and you're like, oh, this is.
It didn't really just happen overnight, did it?
Yeah. It's amazing the things that did happen. Never mind. That's a whole different show.
yeah, for sure. But, so today we have a great show.
Yes, we do. We have an excellent show. And this is one of those shows I really love because this is the first time we've had two individuals in here with us, and they're on opposite sides of things.
An actual debate.
Yeah, you could call it that, or you refer to it as a grudge match. Or
yeah, like a cage match. It's a throwdown between an opponent for and, a proponent for and an opponent against two proposals that are making their way through Portland and the Oregon legislature, which is to ban or no longer allow and get rid of single family zoning. And the issue is people on one side say we can't build enough housing when so many parts of our city and our state are restricted to only single family homes. Other people say, well, if you just get rid of the zoning without any other considerations, you're going to wind up destroying neighborhoods and actually making the displacement problem worse. So these two folks are very smart folks. They've been on these shows before, on this show before, and they're just going to hash it out. And at the end, I will actually weigh in as well, which is I've never done that before. So I'm going to have a final word. So hang on through the whole show. And it's important because the Oregon legislature could be voting on this proposal as soon as today, Thursday, when this show is posting.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into it.
Thanks so much for being here, guys. This is a very special interview. We've never had two guests on simultaneously. So we have Meg Hansen, who is a data activist and systems engineer. She was on one of our most popular podcasts, which was one about fighting for affordable housing through historic preservation. Michael Anderson, who's a senior researcher at Sightlines Institute, who was on another podcast that was extremely popular with us, which was all about zoning and the history of zoning. And so we're here today to talk about the fight over single-family housing. Thank you both for coming here.
Thanks. Yeah.
Good to be back.
Yeah.
So just to start off, can you describe, Michael, sort of a little bit of the history of zoning? We talked about zoning in the past for our big zoning show, but if you could describe just very briefly what zoning is and some of the racial history behind zoning.
Sure. And can I contextualize that with a couple things too first?
Sure, absolutely.
Just preliminaries. I'm glad to be talking with Meg. As we were talking before the show, I think we agree on many things. We happen to disagree strongly on this issue, and I really respect her judgment and opinions on sort of how the way a lot of things work. We disagree on these opinions differ, so it's interesting and fun to talk to somebody who we disagree with, but also respect and like.
And this is the opportunity to have that conversation and also to have like a cage match.
Right, exactly.
Sort of
and now we're about to throw down. Okay, cool.
And what is yeah. zoning, really?
It's a law that you can pass that says you're allowed to do this on a property or you're not allowed to do something on a property.
Right, and we spoke about this in the zoning podcast, which is, you know, land is divided up into what you can and cannot build on that based on the use of the
right.
building that goes on it, whether that's a factory or a house, or and then density-wise. An apartment building can be built there or just a single-family home, right? Mm-hmm. And you had brought up that historically zoning had come about in many communities as a way of segregating them mm-hmm. because only wealthier people could afford single-family houses or large lot developments, and that those wealthy people were traditionally white.
Right.
Just to establish what the conversation is about, there is a proposal both in the city and in the state legislature that the city would get rid of the single-family zone, and the state would also get rid of the single-family zone in towns and cities of 10,000 people or more. And this is part of a national conversation that's going on. There's just a story in the New York Times that said how many cities around the country were looking at getting rid of these zones because there's just not enough housing to go around. And so they have interesting maps that show what percentage of these various cities are made up of single-family housing. So Minneapolis, 70% of its single-family housing is single-family. Portland, 77%. Charlotte is 84%. New York City, by contrast, is only 15% of New York City is, and that's all five counties, is single-family zone. Seattle, our neighbor, is 81%. And so the idea is to get rid of these zones in order to provide more affordable housing. So Megan, finally, what's wrong with that?
Well, first of all, the word affordable. A lot of these dialogues are promoting this idea, two things, that without any other regulatory countermeasures, without tethering this lifting of zoning restrictions to things that are explicitly anti-displacement or environmental protections, or, you know, even a whole basket that, you know, you could say would represent those types of things. So the word affordable, it's not mandated. And so this idea that just by changing zoning, there will be affordability, and that just by changing zoning, there will be an increase in racial equity, mm-hmm. in inclusivity, without any regulations mm-hmm. that actually counterbalance the fact that you are increasing the speculative value of the land in the midst of a crisis of affordability, and also in the context of a housing market where housing has been financialized as a high yield commodity, mm-hmm. and Wall Street is now in the landlord business.
So, for example, in my neighborhood, which I just described, has single family homes, duplexes, quads. It's got many, many kind of mid-size apartment buildings of about 100 units or a little bit less. So they just built a duplex, knocked down a single-family house, built a duplex. Each unit is being sold for $1 million. That's not providing affordable housing. How do you respond to that kind of dynamic that's going on, Michael?
Yeah, first of all, I would say that I'm not among those claiming. There are some claiming. I think, like, Ben Carson, for example, is claiming that, yes, it is the main thing that we should be doing is just deregulating. And I'm not certainly not claiming that. I'm not saying that this is enough to achieve racial equity. I'm not saying that this is...
And when you say deregulating, you mean like have no zoning at all or something?
I don't know what his position is.
Which I'm Ben Carson.
My position is that it should be allowed...
Head of housing and urban development.
Yes.
Yeah. He may not even know what his position is.
That's it's fair. All pyramids. Right. We're just building pyramids on everything.
Right. I don't know. My position is that we shouldn't discriminate against buildings purely because they have two or three or four front doors. My answer to your question, which mm-hmm. I think is totally valid and important, is that, first of all, I would guess that each of those duplex units is cheaper than any one-unit home that has been built newly in your area, and the...
No, it's not true. I mean, I couldn't sell my home for $1 million.
No, a newly built.
Well, you know, it's a good question because there hasn't been anything newly built as far as a single family home is concerned. Mm-hmm. But it seems to be a reflection of the amenities that are built into that house.
Sure.
They built it as a luxury house.
I'm not claiming that this $1 million duplex is affordable to more than a tiny sliver of the population. Right. But I am saying that we should be comparing it to the thing that we are also not doing anything to restrict, which is the construction of a giant one-family home in the area that is new construction and is often inhabited by two or three people who have a bunch of money from a sale of a California home where they've had this massive catastrophic shortage for a generation. In any case, I think the best approach to allow an actual integration of different prices in a given area, so a high amenity area like yours, where it has become since you bought into it, should be able to allow more units in a structure, to let people divide the structure among multiple households as best they can. And it should allow a structure to be larger if it contains more units, thus resulting in the construction of more units. And I think it should also cap the total size of the structure, and it should set a lower cap on the structure's size if it has fewer units. So in a duplex, the city's proposal right now is to say that on a 5,000 square foot lot, you could only go up to 3,000 square feet total, so 1,500 square feet in that duplex. I'm certain that the duplex you're saying that it was very expensive was much larger than 1,500 square feet on a side.
So, you know, again, like the kind of the basis of this issue is that the proponents of this proposal to get rid of the single family zone want to be able to build more units to allow more units to be built in a city that is pretty much full because there's just no more room to build because it's zoned for a limited number of housing units through single family zoning, right? And on the other side,
I would disagree with that.
So you think there's enough, if we didn't upzone, there would be enough units to accommodate the people who want to move here.
The question is whether there are enough units to accommodate the people who want to move here in the places they want to live, in the ways they want to live, and at the prices they want to live.
Okay. So it's essentially we need to increase the supply of housing through allowing more housing
built. Among other ways, right. But we also need to think about the specific places that supply is increased. So I want to give Meg a chance to talk. So go ahead.
Yeah, we'll get this in. I just want to make sure the issue is kind of framed so people understand. And so there's one group that wants to increase the supply of housing, which is restricted.
Among other methods. Yeah, right. Yeah, so like it is essential to build enough homes for the people who are moving here to live here. That's one step, but that's also not the end of the story. And I think sometimes it's mischaracterized as if people who think that we should build more homes also think that's the only thing we should do. And that's definitely not my position.
Okay. And then the other side is that, well, if you upzone in many neighborhoods, you're going to kind of bulldoze the neighborhood. You're going to destroy the character of the neighborhood. If it's a historic neighborhood, you're going to take old houses and subdivide them into, many units, old big houses. Or you're going to incentivize people to knock down houses and build larger buildings. And so there's a historic preservation concern on the other side, as well as I think what Megan's particular position is, which is that much of the existing single family housing or low density housing is currently providing affordability to many people who are already in place, and this would be disruptive.
So a couple of things. First of all, to just some counterpoint on a couple of things, that there is no relationship between square footage and market rate. We've seen that with micropod apartments, where you've got 300 square feet that it renting for $4 to $5 a square foot. We've got single family homes that are renting for a dollar a square foot. And so this idea that this that affordability without a regulatory mandate will be created by virtue of incentivizing, not requiring, but incentivizing through upzoning, building smaller multifamily housing. And yet, none of this legislation prohibits what is currently also taking place, which is these large, expensive single-family homes also being built, converted into rentals or Airbnbs.
Now, the city legislation does prohibit that.
Excuse me?
The city legislation does prevent the large construction of large one-unit buildings, right? That's the...
By virtue of square footage?
Mm-hmm.
So you're taking exception with the large part?
Yes.
They can still build single-family... They can still build new single-family homes. They're just not monstrosities. But right. we've also seen with the revalorization of the urban core, the market rate for something, you know, these duplexes that you were talking about, you know, those each one of those selling for over $1 million. There are other right. smaller single family homes, so there's no relationship there.
I don't agree with that. But
okay, well, okay, let me sort of throw a question out. So what I think we're talking around is that increasing the housing supply or the amount of units built doesn't immediately lower costs. So for example, 15% of New York City is zoned single family. It's unaffordable to live in New York City. 77% of Portland is zoned single family. It's unaffordable to live in Portland. So like uses and density are not necessarily driving affordability.
Yeah, it's not the density per se. It's the amount of homes per person looking for housing.
Right. So how does this policy affect that when the immediate upshot of upzoning will be that people will build more units, developers will build more units, but they'll still charge mm-hmm. a very high price for them as long as the market will bear.
Well, so will landlords, right? So mm-hmm. will any homeowner, so will any home seller. People will charge what the market will bear, and they will be able to charge more if there are not enough homes in an area. We could solve the supply problem in Portland by sprawling and becoming Phoenix or Atlanta or Charlotte.
Right, which is another question. But
right. I think it's better for us to solve the problem by building up and in instead and having enough homes for people to live in.
But that's the question. How does building more homes address, at least in the short term, mm-hmm. affordability?
I think the promise of building enough homes for people to live in is that it prevents current landowners from being able to charge whatever the heck they want. In the last 5 years in Portland, landlords and home sellers have been able to gouge buyers and renters as much as 10% a year increases, because there have been so many more people trying to move here in the wake of the Great Recession after we had 3 years where nobody built anything. That's happened in city after city after city around the country. And it's the same long-term phenomenon
here. So affordability will trickle down. So even
no, I wouldn't say it that way. I would say that the...
It will filter over.
Okay, I'm sorry.
The benefit of building enough homes is that the older homes become expensive less. The best thing you can expect from building enough homes is that things don't go up in price. I don't think it's reasonable to expect that building enough homes goes down in price. That's why we need other mechanisms mm-hmm. to provide for people who are housing challenged because of low incomes. There are about a fifth of the country is making too little money to pay for just the taxes and upkeep and replacement value of a structure. Mm-hmm. And the only way to solve that is with more money given to those people to keep them in secure housing. And that's a huge, massively important part of the picture here that we're not going to address through the zoning code, but needs to be addressed through taxation.
So to a little bit of Michael's point is like numbers, supply affects price, right? It's ironclad. Whether you're in Oregon, we have a unique system of urban growth boundaries that restricts growth around the edges of the city. Whether you expand that urban growth boundary and let the area sprawl, or whether you increase zoning density, more units simply means over time, each unit will cost less.
Perhaps in 30 years. Aggregate supply. So first of all, let's be clear where this crisis of affordability that these bills portend to address lies in terms of income levels. We're talking people who are earning incomes of below 60% median family income. That's where the acute shortage and even more acute shortage of affordable housing is. And part of the erasure of that has come through a real estate speculative investment, buying at a bargain, buying cheap rental housing and replacing it with that which is not affordable. But for-profit development is only going to build for the top of the market. And right now, over 80-some percent of new units are luxury, 4 and 5 star, priced way out of range, beyond what residents can actually afford, and at the same time displacing low-income renters and communities of color, and there's no market for them. And so this idea that more aggregate supply is somehow going to create affordability also assumes that rental, and we're talking mostly about rental because that's where the crisis of affordability, puts people out on the streets and kills. So that idea also speaks of the rental market as if it were this unified market and not in reality a tiered market. So you've got, in market parlance,
monolithically.
You've got luxury market rates. You've got Class A luxury stuff, and then you've got affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And those are separate and distinct markets. And that housing does, that affordability does not create mm-hmm. the kind of and the massive amounts of what it does is it creates a glut of supply.
So can I respond to some of this? Mm-hmm. I don't want to cut you off. Sorry.
No, please.
So obviously, that's where I take issue is this idea that all new housing is beneficial to pricing mm-hmm. when we are not the ones building the houses. We are saying, okay, for-profit developers, we are going to increase the speculative value of the land statewide, build what you want, where you want it. They are going to,
You support upzoning if it was tied legislatively to affordable housing or submarket housing? You could have an upzone, but you're going to have to provide one of these 4 units
and I've always stated this too, that personally, I live in a neighborhood, I live in an internally converted fourplex, turn of the century. What I love about my neighborhood is the mix of housing types and the affordability. Mm-hmm. And I'm also concerned about demolitions and policy that incentivizes and is predicated mm-hmm. on the demolition of support it.
Okay.
I would support the kind of changes that allow different housing types to be built if it were explicitly tethered to reasonable demolition restrictions, so that actually incentivizes infill instead of displacement, stronger tenant protections, mm-hmm. and strong environmental protections. And so if you're going to demolish sound habitable housing, then it should explicitly be tethered to some exception criteria that also include a HUD standard of affordability. If you're going to take more away, if you're going to take something away, you have to put more back.
And the problem with that is that if we are doing that only on new buildings that are being built, we're ignoring all the 70% of low-density homes that exist now and are the landlords and sellers of those homes can charge whatever they want for it in this regime. So you need to – if we're going to have this price-regulated regime, which I'm not – theoretically opposed to in a large way, we would need to do it on all homes, or else the only people who are going to benefit are the current landowners.
So let's move on.
Can I go back to? I've got a personal example on this too that I think hopefully helps talk about the benefits of this. So I live in an ADU, backyard cottage that we went in with our former housemates on. I used to live in the upstairs of some folks who bought their house at the trough of the recession, and helped them pay their mortgage at the time, and we had my now wife moved in. Our roommates had a kid. We got pregnant. We knew we needed to get some more space one way or another. We thought about maybe we should try and buy one of these cheaper older homes in the area. We didn't really want to. We didn't want to be that separated from our community. We didn't want to be on our own, and we didn't want a yard. So instead, we took money that could have been a down payment, theoretically, and went in with our housemates. They took out a home equity loan, built an ADU in the backyard, and we were able to move in there. If that had not happened, we would have outbid somebody else for the home that we were going to consider buying or renting from someone else, because we would have paid slightly more than whoever else could have otherwise landed in that home. And then whoever we priced out would have paid slightly more than somebody else for some other house and so on. It doesn't take 30 years for that to show up in the market. It takes like 3 years for that to show up in the market. And that is the 3 years that we've had since we stopped building homes in Portland.
So you're saying that the quote unquote, I know you don't like the term trickle down,
no.
but or cascade, there'll be a cascading effect.
Yes, it's a freaking like a waterfall that happens over the course of a few cycles.
Of affordability will happen within a few years rather than...
That is the mechanism by which building enough homes for people to live in gets people in homes. I don't think that's a controversial concept.
I'm gonna just interject just an objective point, which from the narrator here, moderator. So CoStar, which is a big corporate landlord monitoring agency and publication, said last year that rents had been falling in Portland in part because of the relocation fee and supply that had been created. You're gonna take issue with
I'm
that.
I'm gonna take issue with that.
But we're gonna move on to another point, just because we don't get bogged down in just any one
it's
single
really
issue.
Important,
there's a lot
though.
Of issues.
There's a difference between rent growth rates and rent prices.
Well, no,
rent
that's very
growth
true.
Rates have been coming down, but they're still positive, meaning rents are still going up. And that is something that is often misconstrued. Rents have not been going down. Rent growth rates have been decreasing. Now they're at like 1.2, but rents are still going up.
And wages are going up.
And hopefully, I mean, rents will never go down. You know, just wages go up.
And not now that there's rent-backed mortgage securities that are being publicly traded either, like stocks.
Sure.
Meg's terror about that.
Yeah, it's really awful.
So maybe that's another show. Another concern that opponents have is that, you know, it's going to bulldoze my neighborhood. If you convert my single family neighborhood, maybe it's a historic neighborhood or maybe it's a affordable sort of mid-century neighborhood. They're going to bulldoze all these houses. They might bulldoze my own house if I'm renting in order to fit more people in. So, Meg, is that a concern on your side as well? Is that accurate?
My major concern is that in upzoning and increasing the speculative value of the land without any protective countermeasures, that incentivizes displacement, that incentivizes for-profit development looking to buy at a bargain and replace at a premium. And there's no requirement that they replace it with multifamily. This is late-stage capitalism that we're living in. All we need to do to look around is see the proof of how this industry operates and how that kind of opportunism will and myopic thirst for profits will expand to exploit whatever the limits are of regulation.
So you do think that people will bulldoze housing?
Absolutely.
Does historic overlays, is there a caveat or a carve out in the current city or state proposal that would say a historic neighborhood, you could not bulldoze a house in a historic neighborhood, for example?
So for using Portland as an example, the only restrictions, the only time that a demolition permit is even subject to review is within a historic district. And that is a federal designation, a federal process.
Not a local. There's different grades of historic neighborhoods.
The federal restriction doesn't determine anything about development.
The designation is what subjects it to demolition review.
Which is a local decision.
But it's a federal designation.
It's a federal designation.
A local decision in terms of the demolition.
If you're in a federal historic district,
yes.
You have to get a local review in order to demolish
a
house.
But there is
that's a local decision that's the case. The feds don't tell you that you can't demolish a historic
house. The question is there anything in this, and this is not a housing bill, by the way. These are not housing bills. They're real estate bills. Let's make that clear. if none of these zoning, increasing the speculative value of the land are actually tied to things like affordability and tethered to that, then it's about real estate and not about housing, especially in an economy and in a market that has financialized housing as a high-yield commodity divorced completely from any of its social utilities. So I am worried about a couple of things. I'm worried about displacement, and I'm not the only one. So in this local version of middle housing, Planning Sustainability Commission, 5-4 vote, those four voting in opposition to it specifically, explicitly, repeatedly said that their opposition was based on this increasing the displacement, particularly in vulnerable communities, particularly in low-income families and communities of color. And it says something when all three of the commissioners of color are the ones voting against it. Commissioner Bao also testified in opposition to House Bill 2001, saying that it probably goes afoul of federal fair housing standards because of the disparate displacement impact. And in our local discussion about residential infill, and he's the only African American commissioner on that board, by the way. He repeatedly said, "This is displacement policy. This is institutionalized racism. This is worse than redlining, because at least with redlining, it was like you can't live here, but you can live here. But with this kind of broad stroke displacement policy, there is no market." And so that tethering is really important. Without it, then it incentivizes demolition, it incentivizes destruction of the urban canopy, and it incentivizes gentrification and increased segregation rather than remedying it.
Okay, let's so we started off with, will it bulldoze the neighborhood? Proceeded to historic neighborhoods don't have any special protection. If it does increase density in historic or wealthy neighborhoods that are predominated by big lot, single family houses, especially if they're old ones, I mean, that's pretty much rich white people are in there, right? Wouldn't that then, to Michael, increase diversity or at least increase opportunity for people of less means to be able to live in these neighborhoods that often have transportation, or they have stores and other amenities, they have parks because they have low crime? Isn't that a way of increasing diversity?
Yeah, for sure it is. So if there's no way to consider the Laurelhurst right now is anything but exclusionary, if you look at the fact that the average home costs more than $800,000, and there is no way to live in virtually any lot in the Laurelhurst district without buying a minimum amount of land, and you're within a 3-minute walk of Max Line that runs every 3 minutes to downtown and Gateway. My personal position is that we should definitely have 6-story buildings there. They should be mixed income by mandate, and we should be funding array of below market homes mixed into those buildings. That would be the best way to, and the first place where we should be increasing the number of homes in the city. I think just doing that would have a much larger benefit to supply than the proposal here, which has not, the ones we're talking about are not primarily like increasing the number of units in the city or the state proposal, though I think they would do a fair amount for that. They're primarily a neighborhood level, block level integration of incomes, especially over the long term. So I don't want to overrepresent the benefits of this. And that actually speaks to your question about tearing down housing. I was talking about the North Tabor neighborhood. It's a nice place. It's a roughly middle-class neighborhood, though it is also gentrifying because of the lack of homes. And the area within 6 blocks of my home has been legal to build duplexes and triplexes on for the last 30 years. We've got a few buildings in there that have gone up that have a duplex here and a triplex there and so on. It's not a radical change. I sort of wish it were a more radical change. I feel like our neighborhood would be better because it is close to this awesome Max stop if it had a lot more housing and a lot more variety of income. But the fact is that it's not a radical change that we're talking about with just letting people add a unit or remodel a property or whatever. I completely share Meg's concern about the financialization of real estate. I don't think we're going to address that through the zoning code. And in fact, if anything, allowing up to 4 units on a property lets people take out an FHA loan on a property that they have paid off. If they've got their mortgage out, they can let their extended family live on the same lot with them. They can, as we have, extend a small community of things and get a low-cost, homeowner-initiated development process that doesn't require you to be a banker to create more homes.
Now also, like, just on the kind of the wealthy neighborhoods, aren't a lot of the opponents to this bill coming from those wealthy neighborhoods?
Yes.
Like a Democrat from Eastmoreland there's been some talk about her trying to sink the bill. Is that been also your experience? Is it more opponents are coming from wealthier neighborhoods than
every single person who testified against House Bill 2001 was over 50 and a homeowner?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Every single one?
I'm not sure. Did you?
I've been involved. I've looked through all of the testimony.
Okay, sorry.
And
you weren't including written testimony.
That's just so problematic in so many ways because it feeds into this narrative that, and granted, here in Portland, one of the whitest cities in the nation, Andre Baugh on the PSC, by the way, said that if RIP passed, it would be...
And that's the residential infill...
Residential infill project, which is
the Portland's
version of middle housing.
I don't deny that Andre has this position as well. You're right.
I don't deny that he has his position, but I also don't. But I also believe that it resonates. And in particular, here in white Portland, in white Oregon, we're having a completely different discussion about the very same thing than people in South Central LA are having about upzoning in their single-family neighborhoods. And there is a lot more vociferous opposition to these same statewide real estate bills saying, who is this for? It's not for low-income renters. It's not for communities of color. And you mentioned, an $800,000 home in Laurelhurst. What about the $1.1 million duplexes that are being built in working-class communities?
Mm-hmm.
And Senate Bill 608, which was pushed through rapidly by our Democratic supermajority, also exempts all of this new construction that would be incentivized through House Bill 2001 and residential infill project locally, exempts them for 15 years from any pricing controls. So that's an added layer of bull. And when we focus just on racial equity, when we narrow this conversation down to just zoning, and we don't talk about how real estate finance and iteration after iteration through FHA loan scandals in the 70s or the extraction predominantly in African American communities in targeted during the subprime loan crisis, like it's the financial aspect of real estate that is at the heart of racial capitalism. And when white
but you can only address so much in a land use bill. I think we agree.
Right.
It's a land use bill.
I completely agree with that. We're not going to change that during the zoning.
Don't call it affordable and don't call it a remedy for racial segregation.
Can we talk about the affordable housing community? People who build affordable housing, nonprofit developers, are loudly in favor of both House Bill 2001 and the local reform because it will let them build these family size units more cheaply than they can in greater numbers in more neighborhoods than they can currently operate. And the reason for the lack of range of operation is because the...
What do you mean by lack of range of operation?
The reason that Habitat for Humanity can't build in Laurelhurst...
Mm-hmm. And PCRI and all these other local nonprofit groups that want to provide affordable housing.
Is that it's illegal to build the housing type that they build. So Habitat builds in Portland almost exclusively middle housing, so duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, et cetera. They can only do that in areas where they're legally allowed to do that. The places where they're currently legally allowed to do that, generally speaking, are places where there were, over the last two generations, less political power and less people willing to say, we don't want these changes in our area, we wanted it somewhere else.
They were people less desirable
like,
neighborhoods.
A neighborhood like Laurelhurst,
desirable.
Like Eastmoreland, like Dunthorpe, can say changes should happen, but let's let them happen somewhere else. And so the path of least resistance led to North and Northeast Portland, which is why I think a lot of places in Cornelius's neighborhood, you actually can build a duplex, and currently it's unrestricted in supply or in size and
five units
on
corners in some residential areas.
This is what we hear all the time, is that we can't build affordable housing in a neighborhood, expensive place like Dunthorpe. Mm-hmm. We can't build, like,
and this
to
would
create
let them do
mixed
it.
Income neighborhoods, it's almost impossible to subsidize a single-family home in Dunthorpe.
The reason that Habitat for Humanity is, like, passionately supportive of House Bill 2001 is because it would let them build this in many more locations, in higher amenity neighborhoods, in different situations, and you could integrate neighborhoods at the block level through subsidized homes. That would also occur in the future that we need to simultaneously be building, where we are, as Meg says, doing much more than just reforming zoning, where we are funding nonprofits like PCRI, like Habitat, to do these things.
But let's differentiate between those nonprofit housing developers like Habitat for Humanity who support this because it will allow them to build subsidized housing. Mm-hmm. Let's separate that. Let's separate that out because I understand why they support it. But the Dash 22 amendments, I believe it was, there was a Dash 22 amendments to how the statewide upzoning House Bill 2001 that basically would mandate affordability. I believe it was 80% median family income. That was thrown out. Mm-hmm. And so they can still, I can see how that helps them. But we are talking about, you know.
So there was an affordable housing clause in the bill.
There was a Dash 22 amendment. There was a Dash 22 amendment up for review, and
It was thrown out at the request of the affordable housing developers, who said that we regularly want to use the market rate rules to develop homes because that's the simplest way to do it. And so Julia Metz at PCRI, who was a key architect of the residential infill project and the House Bill 2001 inputs as well, says that when she was developing family size subsidized below market projects in Northeast Portland, they would, in some cases, they needed to have different prices within a unit structure, within like a single property, so that a family could evolve as it goes through. If somebody gets a new job, then you don't want to kick them out of their home to, you can move them next to the next unit.
But let's differentiate subsidized affordable housing, because that's being supported by those corporations, but that is not in these, that is not part of these policies. These policies don't mandate.
These policies advance their work.
And yet they also advance the evisceration of communities by the same folks that are currently to blame for our crisis of affordability.
Does a giant one-unit home not eviscerate a community?
Okay, I'm gonna move on here. So another sort of issue that I see here is that these bills are both the local and the statewide are sort of blanket upzoning. They don't take in sort of neighborhood context, whether that's race, class, or geography, or transit. That in the past, Portland has had a policy where they want to upzone in places where people can walk around, where they can access transit. And this seems to be, especially the statewide proposal, to be indiscriminate, right? It's not like, well, we're going to have higher densities graduate up towards places where you can walk around, meaning your single-family homes are the ones that are furthest away from transit, and the high-density houses and apartments are closest to bus stops or train stops and things like that. This seems to be just like a blanket, indiscriminate upzoning, which also seems to kind of be very anti-Jane Jacobs, who is all about neighborhood context. Maybe I'm reading it wrong, but is it kind of just sort of one-size-fits-all upzoning, Michael?
That is why it would not be as appropriate to say everywhere you can build six stories, right? That's not what this bill does, and anybody's talking about. What they're saying is everywhere a city cannot discriminate based on the number of doors on a project. They can regulate in many other ways. They can regulate the design of a building, they can regulate the size of a building, they can regulate the positioning of a building and the lot, and the amount of lot it takes up. The only difference is under the state law, if this passes, the number of kitchens in a building, the number of households that are dividing the cost of a certain location, that's not a relevant public concern.
But let's also talk about that, that blanket, and let's talk about the impact and two sides of that coin. So let's talk about the actual enclaves of wealth and privilege, like Dunthorpe, who is unincorporated, by the way, so would still be able to be in.
No, it's affected.
It is affected
by 2001.
But because statewide, yeah.
It affects the Portland metro area.
It's not a city.
Right, but It's in the Portland metro. That's good to know.
Yeah. That's good to know. But there, so let's we'll talk about the, these enclaves that could that have plenty of room, and let's talk about the impact there versus the impact, let's say in Lentz, let's say, or in districts that are heavily populated by renters that are currently paying below market, and as soon as you increase the speculative value of that land, those properties go up in value, and renters understand intuitively, and communities of color, they don't need to read an MIT study by some white guy to understand what gentrification is and what it feels like, and how real estate through all of these iterations can put a feel-good label on things that don't benefit anybody but wealthy white privileged real estate investors. And so the impact is completely different in places where it is, where you've got a high concentration of people that are already living on the edge and are going to be displaced en masse because their properties are the cheap ones. But hey, it's in the urban center, you know, now that this has been revalorized. And so the impact of it is also disparate. That's where this these broad strokes allow real estate speculators and Wall Street private equity hedge fund landlords to go shopping anywhere there's a bargain. And if it happens to be in a federally designated opportunity zone, cool. Then you don't have to pay any capital gains taxes. So
all of what you just said,
it's a layered exacerbation and perpetuation of the very things that, that this narrative says it's going to address.
All of that is completely true, except the fact that it also applies to one-unit buildings. It applies to a home, a one-unit home that is remodeled and resold and flipped for $550,000, right? It's happening all the time. And I think most renters also know intuitively that their main concern is not actually their building being torn down. It's their building going up in price. Almost all displacement is due to the building going up in price. Obviously, demolition is a relevant question here and something we should talk about, and especially be trying to minimize in communities of color and other culturally important centers. But the main concern of tenants is rises in costs, not in the building that they live in, right?
So
it's okay. All of that. Anything that displaces or costs me more.
We want to wrap up here, so I want to give us two questions to sort of wrap up a really great conversation so far. And that is just, are there any points you think people need to know about your position that we haven't discussed, if you can, that is specific to the two proposals that are before public decision-making bodies? Not so much sort of the finances and not so much sort of like the big national picture, but just about what's in front of them as elected officials and as constituents who live in these districts that will be affected?
Two things. First, there is no housing crisis. There's only an affordable housing crisis. People with money have plenty of options. And we cannot solve or mitigate displacement, racial disparity, segregation by fueling it, and fueling it through policies that provide greater opportunity for the same industry that evicts us, exploits us, and securitizes and trades in our rent checks on Wall Street to drive up profits, to conjure trillions in fictitious wealth. And we know how that ended the last time when they were just focused on securitizing single family houses. And now the economy has recovered. The Wall Street has recovered, but the pocketbooks of renters are hurting even more severely. So this doesn't solve for it. Obviously, these solutions are complicated, but this type of statewide legislation without any regulatory countermeasures exacerbates, perpetuates, and fuels exactly that which it claims to, in this progressive style, to address.
I think the regulatory countermeasures are definitely needed, and they need to be passed at the local level, because the ways that we can prevent displacement in Portland are different from the ways that we can prevent displacement in Medford and different from Grants Pass and so on. So the state action says there is no need to discriminate against a building because it has multiple front doors or multiple kitchens. The decisions of how to prevent rapid change in whatever neighborhoods we want to prevent the rapid change in, and the ways to advance affordability, both subsidized and market rate, at the local level, are up to the cities. It needs to be up to the cities because the financial conditions are different in different cities.
And yet much of this legislation preempts local control. Senate Bill 608,
it preempts the local control over the number of front doors. That's what it does.
And 608 preempts the local control from mitigating displacement through rent stabilization.
Sure,
Those two things are coupled together, and they were pushed through by the same legislative champion and authored by the same industry.
Yeah, we can talk about 608 in another podcast. Great.
Yeah, lots more to talk about. You guys are great. Do you want to say, I know you guys both agree. We wanted to say what you agreed on.
Mm-hmm.
You both agreed on the financial markets and their influence on the affordable housing crisis. Anything else that you guys agree on in terms of these proposals?
Do we both agree that wealthier neighborhoods with more people who can deal with the consequences of displacement are the best places to add new housing, other things equal?
I don't think that these policies even do
they don't.
That.
No,
I mean, I think that's a whole separate conversation.
I think this policy is a counter to that tendency where, like we were talking about before, the path of least resistance leads to upzoning of North Northeast Portland or Lentz, but not to the upzoning of Laurel.
I think that we do agree on the need for more regulatory countermeasures that are not present. But I also do think that that where we do agree, if there were explicitly tethered, not these fraction things that said, well, we're going to do this over here and this is going to add fuel to the fire, but we're just going to defer and hope that the bureaucracy over there funds these anti-displacement things. But I do think that where we do agree is that, at least from my standpoint, if those regulatory countermeasures were firmly in place that incentivized more conscientious, responsible, and a better trade-off, to incentivize but also rein in the avarice of profit-seeking real estate industry, then I would not take so much of an issue with upzoning. But so I think we agree at least on stuff that still needs to happen. I think where we disagree is that I think that they have to be tethered together and passed together, or else the cart goes before the horse and development gets there first.
And I would say that we probably disagree on that regard on the extent to which we can restrain the avarice of the development industry without also restraining the avarice of every other landowner and property owner in the state, in the world, in the country. Like, if we exact all of our desires to restrain avarice only on people who are building homes and not at all on the people who are remodeling homes and selling homes for whatever they're worth and renting to people who don't have any protections, then the only effect will be that we won't have any more homes. That's bad, too.
We can be
nuanced. Well, we'll just have to end it there. And okay. That's definitely an agreement to disagree. And thank you both. It's been a great conversation. And we'll see what happens.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, we all entered the cage match, but we all get to leave.
Well, that was Meg Hansen and Michael Anderson. They did a great job of really trying to be very civil to each other. They are very civil to each other, and it's always interesting to see two Oregonians get in an argument because it's just usually just so polite. I over the years and on this show I've supported and we've given a lot of airtime to policies, including inclusionary zoning, the relocation fee here in Portland, and now in other parts of the country, rent stabilization or rent control, affordable housing bonds, land trusts, increased density. I've supported all of these things as ways of providing more affordable housing. On this issue, though, I do think the current proposals go too far. I think that they do not take in enough other mitigating factors that should be considered, whether that's the location of a neighborhood, whether it's historic quality, whether it's the density could coincide with supporting transit and pedestrian-oriented communities. I think that the impulse of this proposal, both at the state and at the city, are correct. I think they're very close in some respects to getting it right. But I think this time around, I don't support it this time around. I think it goes too far, and just it's one size fits all, and it's going to kind of be a mess. So good work on the parts of the advocates and the legislators who want to see it pass, but I personally just don't see it at this time. But we'll see what happens. And thank you all, guys, for listening into that whole show. And you will hear from us again. Our next show is going to be our big audio documentary on Long Beach, part of a continuing series on Long Beach. This will be the final installment, and you won't want to miss it. You will hear from us again.